sink, the old pipes pounded and howled. He thought it was the pipes, or his dizziness, that made the room, the whole building, tremble. He wasn't thinking about the wind from the coast. How strong it was. He wasn't blaming Dr. Larch, either. Homer felt there was nothing as simple as anyone's fault involved. It was not Dr. Larch's fault. Larch did what he believed in. If Wilbur Larch was a saint to Nurse Angela and to Nurse Edna, he was both a saint and a father to Homer Wells. Larch knew what he was doing, and for whom. But that quick and not quick stuff, it didn't work for Homer Wells. You can call it a fetus, or an embryo, or the products of conception, thought Homer Wells, but whatever you call it, it's alive. And whatever you do to it, Homer thought, and whatever you call what you do, you're killing it. He looked at the severed pulmonary artery, which was so perfectly displayed in the open chest of the baby from Three Mile Falls. Let Larch call it whatever he wants, thought Homer Wells. It's his choice. If it's a fetus to him, that's fine. It's a baby to me, thought Homer Wells. If Larch has a choice, I have a choice, too. He picked up the spotless tray and carried it into the hall, like a proud waiter carrying a special dish to a favorite guest. Curly Day, forever snot-nosed, was cruising in the corridor between the dispensary and Nurse Angela's office. He was not allowed to be playing there, but Curly Day had a bored-every-minute look about him. He had the attention span of a rabbit. At the moment, Curly was dragging a cardboard carton through the corridor. It was the carton the new enema bags had come in. Homer recognized the carton because he had unpacked it. "What you got?" Curly Day asked Homer, who held the tray and the dead baby from Three Mile Falls at shoulder level. Curly Day came up to Homer's waist. When Homer got close to the carton, he saw that it was not empty. David Copperfield, Jr. was in the bottom of the carton. Curly Day was giving him a ride. "Get out of here, Curly," Homer said. "Gomer!" cried David Copperfield. "It's Homer, you idiot," Curly Day said. "Gomer!" David Copperfield cried. "Get out of here, please," Homer told them. "What you got?" Curly asked Homer. He reached upward for the edge of the tray, but Homer picked off his dirty little hand. He grabbed Curly at the wrist and twisted Curly's arm behind his back. Homer balanced the tray and its content expertly. Curly Day tried to struggle. "Ow!" Curly cried. David Copperfield tried to stand up in the bottom of the carton, but he lost his balance and sat down. Homer lifted Curly Day's arm behind his back, just slightly higher than the right angle mark, which caused Curly to bend over and rest his forehead on the edge of the enema bag carton. "Cut it out!" Curly said. "You're leaving, Curly, right?" Homer asked. "Yeah, yeah," Curly said, and Homer let him go. "Tough guy," Curly said. "Right," said Homer Wells. "Gomer!" David Copperfield managed to say. Curly Day wiped his nose on his disheveled sleeve. He jerked the carton so suddenly that David Copperfield rolled on his side.
"Hack!"
little Copperfield cried. "Shut up!" Curly said to his cargo. He shuffled away from Homer Wells, to whom he gave a look of peevish sorrow, of aimless complaint, nothing more. His body bobbed from side to side as he made his way with the carton containing David Copperfield. Homer noted that Curly's shoes were on the wrong feet, and one of them was untied, but he decided it would be unworthy criticism to mention this to Curly, who was as buoyant as he was messy, and wasn't his buoyancy more important than his carelessness, especially since he was an orphan? "Goodbye, Curly," Homer said to the boy's slouched back. Curly's untucked shirt hung to his knees. "See you, Homer," Curly said, keeping his face turned away. When he passed the dispensary door, Nurse Edna appeared and scolded him. "You're not supposed to be playing here, Curly," she said. "Yeah, yeah," Curly said. "I'm going, I'm going." "Medna!" David Copperfield cried in a muffled voice from the bottom of the enema bag carton. "It's Edna, you little scum," Curly said. Then Homer was at the door of Nurse Angela's office, which was open. He could see Dr. Larch at the typewriter. The doctor wasn't writing. There wasn't even any paper in the machine. Dr. Larch was just looking out the window. In the doctor's trance-like expression, Homer recognized the peaceful distance that ether provided in those moments when Homer had found the doctor just resting in the dispensary. Perhaps the state of mind that ether occasionally allowed Dr. Larch to enjoy was, increasingly, a state of mind that Larch could summon by just looking out a window. Homer assumed that Dr. Larch used a little ether, because he was in some kind of pain. He suspected that almost everyone in St. Cloud's was in some kind of pain, and that Larch, as a doctor, was especially qualified in remedying it. The smell of ether was so cloying and nauseating to Homer Wells that it was no remedy he would have chosen. It hadn't yet occurred to him what an addiction was. The state of a dream was so present on Wilbur Larch's face that Homer Wells paused in the doorway before continuing his gruesome presentation. He almost turned around and took the baby from Three Mile Falls away with him. But no one encounters the presence of a soul so casually that one can permit the accompanying sense of mission to pass without remarking upon it. And a sense of mission usually requires a gesture more demonstrative than a passing remark. In the doorway of Nurse Angela's office, Homer hesitated. Then he stepped forward and clunked the metal tray down on top of the typewriter. The dead baby from Three Mile Falls was level with Dr. Larch's throat. It was close enough to bite, as they say in Maine. "Dr. Larch," Homer Wells said. Larch looked away from his dream. He stared over the baby at Homer. "The source of the bleeding was the pulmonary artery, which was completely severed, as you see," Homer said, as Larch looked down at the display upon the typewriter. He stared at the baby as if it were something he'd written, come to life, and then to death, at his bidding. Outside the hospital, someone was screaming, but the wind whipped the words to a muddle. The screamer's message sounded confused. "God damn," said Wilbur Larch, staring at the severed artery. "Who's dead, dear?" Nurse Angela asked Curly sweetly. Curly Day had discovered that the station master was dead. Curly didn't know it was the station master. Curly hadn't taken a long enough look. "A guy is dead," Curly said to Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna. Wilbur Larch, who heard this distinctly, got up from the desk and walked past Homer Wells into the hall. "And if it's all the same to you," Homer Wells said to him, "I'd like permission to not be there when you do what you have to do. I want to be of use in any other way, and I'm not disapproving of you," Homer said. "If it's okay, I just don't want to watch it." "I'll have to think about that, Homer," Dr. Larch said. "Let's see who's dead, shall we?" As Homer followed Larch down the hall, he noted that the door to the delivery room was closed and that the door light was on, which meant that Nurse Edna or Nurse Angela had prepared the two women who were waiting for their abortions. The woman from Damariscotta, whose contractions were still slow and regular, probably wouldn't be needing the delivery room until long after Larch was through the two abortions. Homer agreed with Dr. Larch that it was cruel to make the women waiting for the abortions wait any longer than was necessary, especially after they'd been prepared, and so Homer opened the delivery room door and poked his head inside without really looking at either woman. He announced, "The doctor will be right with you. Please don't worry." Homer Wells regretted his timing. Before he could close the delivery room door, Curly Day began his "Dead!" chant all over again. Curly Day possessed the kind of restlessness that would always lead him to unwanted discoveries. He had tired of dragging David Copperfield around in the enema bag carton, and therefore he had conceived of launching young Copperfield, in the carton, off the loading platform at the Boys' Division delivery entrance. It had been a struggle to get the carton and Copperfield up the ramp, but once elevated above the little-used driveway and the tall weeds, Curly imagined that Copperfield might be taught how to almost fly. Surely it wasn't such a high drop. In the carton especially, it wouldn't be much of a fall. And the weedy hill that sloped away from the loading platform would probably allow the enema bag carton to slide. Curly did foresee the possible damage to the carton, the destruction of which would leave him in the company of David Copperfield all alone, and the prospect of Copperfield without a carton or another plaything was powerfully boring. But Curly was already tired of the possible uses of Copperfield with, or in, the carton. He had exhausted the safe things there were to do, and Copperfield was not complaining. Copperfield didn't know he was on the brink of the loading platform. He couldn't see over the sides of the carton. When Curly pushed the carton and Copperfield over the edge, he was careful to keep the carton in an upright position, thus preventing Copperfield from landing on his head. The carton landed on one corner, which collapsed, and young Copperfield was propelled down the bank of tall weeds. Like an unsteady chick staggering out of its shell, he came briefly to his feet before he fell and rolled again and again. From the platform, Curly Day watched the weeds waving at him. If the weeds indicated Copperfield's whereabouts, they were too tall for Curly to actually see Copperfield. Copperfield was not injured, but he was disoriented. He couldn't see Curly, and he couldn't see the carton, which he'd grown rather fond of. When he stopped rolling, he tried to stand, but dizziness, in combination with the uneven ground, unbalanced him, and he sat down. What he sat on was something hard and round, like a stone, but when he looked at what it was, he saw it was the stationmaster's head, face up, eyes open, a strangely accepting terror in the frozen expression. An older child, or even an adult, might have been upset at sitting on the dead stationmaster's face, but young David Copperfield viewed it much as he viewed the rest of the world, with more curiosity than surprise. However, when he touched the face and felt its coldness, the correctness of the child's sensibilities was apparent. The coldness was surely wrong. Young Copperfield leaped away, rolled, came to his feet, ran, fell, rolled again. Finally, on his feet, he began to yelp like a dog. Curly Day began to track him through the tall weeds. "Hang on, hang on, don't get excited," Curly called to the boy. But Copperfield ran and fell in circles, barking strangely. "Stay in one place so I can find you," Curly yelled. He stepped on something that rolled under his shoe. It felt like a freshly fallen branch that had not yet settled into the ground. It was the stationmaster's arm. In an attempt to catch his balance, Curly put his hand on the stationmaster's chest. The wide-eyed, unflinching face, which the tall weeds sheltered from the wind, stared past Curly, undisturbed. And then, in the plot of weeds, there were two barking dogs who moved as if trapped in a maze. It was a testimony to something basically brave and responsible in Curly Day that the boy did not bolt from the weeds until he found David Copperfield. Melanie, at her window, watched the inexplicable thrashing through the weeds. At any time, she could have yelled out to Curly Day and told him the whereabouts of David Copperfield. She could see by the movement of the weeds which yelping animal was where. But she let them fend for themselves. Only when Curly Day was dragging young Copperfield up the driveway, around the boys' division toward the hospital entrance, did Melanie feel inclined to comment. "Hey, Curly, your shoes are on the wrong feet," Melanie called. "You jerk!" But the wind was too strong. Curly couldn't hear her. She couldn't hear what Curly was yelling. She spoke just one more word out the window to no one in particular. She felt that the wind allowed her to say exactly what she felt, from the heart, as loudly as she chose, although she did not even bother to speak loudly. "Boring," she said. But things became more interesting to Melanie when Wilbur Larch and Homer Wells, and Nurse Edna and Nurse Angela, appeared in the driveway by the boys' division delivery entrance. They were clearly searching the plot of tall weeds. "What are you looking for?" Melanie yelled out the window. But either the noise of the wind or the intentness with which the searchers plunged through the weeds caused her question to be ignored. She decided to go see for herself. Melanie felt uneasy about the way this day was developing, but at the same time she felt grateful that something seemed to be happening. That anything at all was happening was vaguely all right with Melanie. This was not a feeling shared by either Candy Kendall or Wally Worthington, who for the last 3 hours had maintained an awkward silence. Their sense of anticipation was too keen to conceal with conversation. It had still been dark when they'd left the coast at Hart's Haven and ventured inland, away from the wind, although the wind was still surprisingly strong. Wally had studied the map so excessively the night before that the white Cadillac moved as purposefully away from the sea as an oyster or its pearl washing resolutely ashore. It was really too windy, even inland, for the top to be down, but Wally preferred the Cadillac when it was a proper convertible, and also, with the top down, with the rush of the wind so noisily in the car, the absence of conversation between him and Candy was less obtrusive. Candy preferred it, too. Her honey-blonde hair was all around her face, such wild swirls of hair surrounding her face at times that she knew Wally couldn't see her expression. Wally knew what her expression was anyway. He knew her very well. Wally glanced at the unread book in Candy's lap. She picked it up to read every so often, but when she returned the book to her lap, the same page was dog-eared. The book was Little Dorrit by Charles Dickens. It was required summer reading for all the girls in Candy's would-be graduating class. Candy had begun it 4 or 5 times, but she had no idea what the book was about or whether she even liked it. Wally, who was no reader, didn't bother to notice the name of the book. He just watched the same dog-eared page and thought about Candy. He was also thinking about St. Cloud's. He was already, in his mind, through the abortion. Candy was recovering nicely, The doctor was telling jokes, all the nurses were laughing. There were enough nurses to win a war in Wally's imagination. All of them were young and pretty. And the orphans were amusing little tykes, with the appropriate gaps in their toothy smiles. In the trunk of Senior Worthington's gliding Cadillac, Wally had three apple crates crammed full of goodies for the orphans. If it had been the proper season, he would have brought them apples and cider. In the spring, there weren't any fresh apples, and there wasn't any cider, but Wally had provided the next best thing, in his opinion. He had loaded the Cadillac with jars and jars of the Worthington's best apple cider jelly and crabapple jelly, and with half-gallon jugs of Ira Titcomb's best apple blossom honey. He imagined arriving for this abortion like Santa Claus. An unfortunate image if one considered Wilbur Larch's memory of the abortion place off Harrison. Wally imagined that Candy was sitting up after her abortion, with that relief on her face of someone who had just had a nasty splinter removed. Oddly, Wally populated the abortion room itself with the aura of celebration one associates with the birth of a welcome child. The air of Wally's wishful thinking was rich with congratulation, and through the light-hearted scene traipsed the cute waifs of St. Cloud's, each with his or her own jar of jelly. Little honey carriers as happy as bear cubs. Candy closed her book and returned it to her lap again, and Wally felt he had to say something. "How's the book?" he said. "I don't know," Candy said, and laughed. He pinched her thigh. Something caught in his throat when he tried to laugh with her. She pinched his thigh in return, a pinch of the exact same passion and pressure as the one he'd given her. Oh, how relieved he was that they were so alike. Through the ever-poorer, gawking towns, as the sun rose and rose, they drove like lost royalty. The oyster-white Cadillac with its dazzling passengers was a head-turner. That scarlet upholstery, so curiously mottled by Senior's accident with the chemicals, was unique. Everyone who saw them pass would not forget them. "Not much farther," Wally said. This time he knew better than to pinch her thigh. He simply let his hand rest in her lap, near little Dorrit. Candy put her hand on top of his, while Melanie, stalking through the girls' division lobby with more than usual purpose, caught Mrs. Grogan's generous and watchful eye. "What's going on, dear?" Mrs. Grogan asked Melanie. "I don't know," Melanie said, shrugging. "You can bet it ain't a new boy in town or nothing." Which was a mild remark for Melanie, Mrs. Grogan thought. How the girl is mellowed. She had mellowed, a little, a very little. Something about the big young woman's determination made Mrs. Grogan follow her outside. "My, what a wind!" Mrs. Grogan exclaimed. "Where have you been?" Melanie thought, but she didn't utter a word. The degree that she had mellowed could be confused with not caring much any more. "It's the station master," said Homer Wells, who was the first to find the body. "That moron," Wilbur Larch muttered. "Well, he's dead, anyway," Homer informed Dr. Larch, who was still struggling through the weeds en route to the body. Dr. Larch refrained from saying that by dying in this manner the station master was intending a further inconvenience to the orphanage. If Wilbur Larch was mellowing, he was also mellowing very little. St. Cloud's was not a place that mellowed you. Homer Wells looked over the weeds that concealed the dead station master and saw Melanie striding toward him. "Oh, please," he felt his heart say to him. "Oh, please, let me leave." The powerful wind swept his hair away from his face. He leaned his chest into the wind, as if he stood on the deck of a ship, heading into the wind, slicing through the waves of an ocean he'd not yet seen. Wilbur Larch was thinking about the weak heart he had invented for Homer Wells. Larch was wondering how he should tell Homer about having a weak heart without frightening the young man or reminding him of the vision frozen upon the face of the station master. What in hell had that fool imagined he'd seen, Dr. Larch wondered, as he helped the others lug the station master's stiffened body to the hospital entrance. Curly Day, who enjoyed being kept busy, had already been sent to the railroad station. Young Copperfield had gone with him, which slowed Curly down considerably, yet Curly was grateful for the company. Curly was slightly confused about the message he was sent to deliver, and Copperfield at least presented Curly with a model listener. Curly practiced the message he thought he was supposed to deliver by saying it aloud to David Copperfield. The message had no visible effect on Copperfield, but Curly found the repetition of the message soothing, and the practice helped him to understand it. Or so he thought. "The station master is dead," Curly announced, dragging Copperfield down the hill. Copperfield's head either nodding agreement or just bouncing loosely between the boy's jerking shoulders. The downhill pace was hard for Copperfield, whose balance wasn't the best, and his left hand, grasped in Curly Day's hand, was pulled high above his left ear. "Dr. Larch says he had a heart attack for several hours," Curly added, which didn't sound quite right to him, but after he repeated it a few times it sounded more reasonable. What Larch had said was that the station master appeared to have had a heart attack several hours ago, but Curly's version felt more or less correct to Curly, the more he said it. "Tell the relatives and friends that there's soon going to be an automobile," said Curly Day, and David Copperfield bobbed in agreement. This didn't sound right to Curly either, no matter how many times he repeated it, but he was sure he'd been told to say something like that. The word was autopsy, not automobile. Curly had part of the word right. Perhaps he thought there was some special car coming to carry the dead. It made a little sense, and a little sense was sense enough for Curly Day, and more sense than Curly saw in most things. "Dead!" David Copperfield cried happily as they approached the train station. Two of the usual oafs were lounging on the bench that faced away from the tracks. They were the sort of louts who hung around the station all day, as if the station were a house of beautiful women, and the women were known to grant favors to all the town's untidy and unemployed. They paid no attention to Curly Day and David Copperfield. "Dead!" David Copperfield called out to them, with no effect. The assistant to the station master was a young man who had modeled his particularly unlikable officiousness upon the officiousness of the station master, so that he had a completely inappropriate old fart, complaining, curmudgeonly aspect to his youthfulness. This in combination with the mean-spiritedness of a dog-catcher who enjoys his work. He was a stupid young man who shared with the station master an aspect of the bully. He would holler at children to keep their feet off the benches, but he would simper before anyone better dressed than himself, and he tolerated any rudeness from anyone who had any advantage over him. He was, without exception, cold and superior to the women who got off the train and asked for directions to the orphanage, and he had not once taken the arm of even one of those women and offered his assistance when they mounted the stairs to the return train. And that first step was a high one. Many of the women who'd been scraped clean had obvious trouble with that first step. This morning the station master's assistant was feeling especially virtuous and disagreeable. He had given 15 cents to one of the louts to go to the station master's house and find him, but the clod had returned with no more information than that the station master's bicycle had fallen over and been left where it had fallen. Ominous, thought the assistant, but frustrating. He was half irritated at having to do the station master's chores, which he'd done poorly, and half thrilled at the prospect of being in charge. When he saw those two dirty urchins from the orphanage crossing the main road in front of the station and coming his way, the station master's assistant felt his authority swell. Curly Day, wiping his nose on one arm, dragging David Copperfield with the other, seemed on the verge of speaking, but the station master's assistant spoke first. "Beat it," he said. "You don't belong here." Curly halted. Young Copperfield collided with him and staggered from the suddenness of the collision. Curly fully believed he belonged nowhere, but he gathered his confidence and delivered quite loudly his rehearsed message. "The station master is dead. Dr. Larch says he had a heart attack for several hours. Tell the relatives and friends that there's soon going to be an automobile." Even the oafs took notice. The assistant was stricken by a flood of sudden and conflicting feelings. That the station master was dead might mean that he, the assistant, would be the next station master. That it was possible for someone to suffer a heart attack lasting several hours was unimaginably painful. And what was this promise or threat about an automobile?
"What relatives? What friends?" the two louts wondered.
"What's that about an automobile?" the assistant asked Curly Day. Curly suspected that he made a mistake, but decided to bluff it out. It was not advisable to display weakness or indecision before a bully, and Curly's crafty instincts for survival led him to choose confidence over the truth. "It means there's a car coming for him," said Curly Day. The two clods looked mildly impressed.
They had not thought the station master was important enough to warrant a car to carry him away.
"You mean a hearse?" asked the assistant. There was a hearse in Three Mile Falls. He'd seen it once, a long black car that moved slowly enough to have been pulled by mules.
"I mean a car," said Curly Day, for whom the word hearse meant nothing at all. "I mean an automobile."
No one moved. No one spoke. Perhaps the symptoms of the special heart attack, reputed to last for several hours, were slowly beginning in all of them. They were all just waiting for the next event of the day, when Senior Worthington's oyster-white Cadillac crept into view. In the many poor and isolated towns they had driven through, Wally and Candy had drawn more than their share of stares, but they were still unprepared for the stunned gaping of the stationmaster's assistant and the extremes of gawking they provoked from the two louts who sat on the bench in front of the station house, as if they'd been nailed there.
"Here we are, St. Cloud's," Wally said to Candy with a clearly false enthusiasm.
Candy could not help herself. She reached for his leg and gripped him at mid-thigh. Little Dorrit plunged from her lap, grazing her locked-together ankles on its way to the Cadillac's floor. The faces of Curly Day and David Copperfield were what struck Candy with the most force. In spite of his grime and dishevelment, Curly Day's face was shining. His smile was a lucky beam of sunlight. It pierced the garbage and revealed the hidden glitter. It was the hugeness of the expectation in Curly's dirty face that took Candy's breath away. Her eyes swam, her vision blurred. But not before the wide openness of David Copperfield's mouth astonished her. From the teardrop shape of his fat lower lip, there hung a clear, healthy string of drool, suspended nearly to his tight little fists, which he clenched against his stomach as if the blinding white Cadillac had knocked the wind out of him as solidly as a punch. Wally wasn't sure, but he thought that the stationmaster's assistant appeared to be in charge of this strange assemblage of people.
"Excuse me," Wally said to the assistant, whose mouth didn't move, whose eyes didn't blink. "Could you tell me the way to the orphanage?"
"You sure got here in a hurry," said the assistant lifelessly.
A white hearse, he was thinking. Not to mention the beauty of the body snatchers. The assistant found he was unable to look at the girl. His mind's eye would never forget its actual brief glimpse of her.
"Pardon me," Wally said. "The man is deranged," Wally was thinking. "I should be talking to someone else." A passing look at the oafs upon the bench was enough to tell Wally that he should not ask them anything. And the littlest child, with the crystal string of slobber now winking like an icicle in the sunlight and reaching nearly to the grass-stained dimples on the child's knees, appeared to be too young for speech.
"Hello," Wally ventured pleasantly.
"Dead," said David Copperfield, the drool dancing like tinsel on a Christmas tree.
"Not him," Wally thought, and sought the eyes of Curly Day.
Curly's eyes were easy to find. They were riveted on Candy.
"Hello," Candy said to him, and Curly Day swallowed visibly and with apparent pain. The wet end of his nose looked raw, but he rubbed it vigorously anyway.
"Could you tell us the way to the orphanage?" Wally asked Curly Day, who, unlike the louts and the assistant, knew that this Cadillac and these angelic specimens of the living had not been sent to retrieve the unwanted body of the dead stationmaster. They wanted the orphanage, thought Curly Day. They've come here to adopt someone, his pounding heart told him. Oh, God, thought Curly Day, let it be me.
David Copperfield, in his typical trance, reached his hand out to touch the perfect monogram on the Cadillac's door. Senior Worthington's gold monogram on the face of a gleaming red delicious apple, with a leaf of spring-green brightness, the artless shape of a tear. Curly batted young Copperfield's hand away.
I got to take charge of things, Curly was thinking, if I want them to pick me.
I'll show you the orphanage, said Curly Day. Give us a ride. Candy smiled and opened the rear door for them. She was a little surprised when Curly picked up young Copperfield and shoved him in the car, not on the seat but on the floor. Copperfield seemed content on the floor. In fact, when he touched the strangely mottled scarlet upholstery of the seat, he pulled back his hand with alarm. He'd never touched leather before, and he jumped as if he feared the seat might be alive. It had been a startling day for young Copperfield, most of the morning confined in an enema bag carton, his first attempt at flight, his long fall through the weeds, then sitting on that dead man's face. What next? Young Copperfield wondered. When the Cadillac began to move, he screamed. He'd never been inside a car before.
He don't know about cars, Curly Day explained to Candy.
Curly himself had never felt leather before either, but he tried to sit on the luxurious seat as if he were born to ride forever in this fashion. He didn't realize that the bleached-out stains that striped the scarlet were the result of an accident with chemicals. It would often be Curly Day's misfortune to mistake an accident for something artistically intended.
"Slow down, Wally," Candy said. "The little one is frightened."
She leaned over the front seat and extended her arms to young Copperfield, whose howling abruptly ceased. He recognized the way her hair fell forward to either side of her face. This, together with her outstretched arms and a certain comfort in her smile, were familiar to Copperfield from Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna. Men, Copperfield thought, pick you up in one arm and carry you over a hip. By men, he meant Homer Wells and Dr. Larch. Curly Day sometimes lugged Copperfield around in this fashion, but Curly wasn't quite strong enough and often dropped him.
Come here, don't be afraid, Candy said to Copperfield,
swinging him over the seat and putting him in her lap. Copperfield smiled and touched Candy's hair. He had never felt blonde hair before. He wasn't quite sure if it was real. He had never smelled anyone who smelled this good, either. He drove his face into the side of her neck and took a great big sniff of her. She actually hugged him, even kissed him on the blue dent of his temple. She looked at Wally and almost cried. Curly Day, sick with envy, gripped the leather seat and wondered what he could say that would make them want him. "Why would anyone want me?" he began to wonder, but he fought off the thought. He sought Wally's eyes in the Cadillac's rearview mirror. It was too painful for him to see the way Candy held David Copperfield.
"You're one of the orphans?"
Wally asked, he hoped tactfully.
"You bet,"
Curly Day said, too loudly. He sounded too enthusiastic about it, he thought.
"I'm not just one of the orphans," he blurted out suddenly. "I'm the best one."
This made Candy laugh. She turned around in the front seat and smiled at him, and Curly felt he was losing his grip on the leather upholstery. He knew he should say something else, but his nose was running so violently he was sure that whatever he said would be grotesque. Before he could drag his sleeve across his face, there was her hand with her handkerchief extended to him. And she wasn't just handing the handkerchief to him, he realized. She was actually pressing the handkerchief to his nose and holding it correctly in place. "Blow," Candy said. Only once had anyone done this for Curly Day. Nurse Edna, he thought. He shut his eyes and blew his nose, at first cautiously.
"Come on," Candy said. "Really blow it."
He really blew it. He blew his nose so emphatically that his head was instantly clear. The delicious scent of her perfume made him giddy. He shut his eyes and wet his pants. Then he lost control and flung himself back in the huge scarlet seat. He saw that he'd blown his nose all over her hand, and she didn't even look angry. She looked concerned, and that made him pee even harder. He couldn't stop himself. She looked completely surprised.
"Left or right?"
Wally asked heartily, pausing at the driveway to the boys' division delivery entrance.
"Left!"
Curly shouted. Then he opened the rear door on Candy's side and said to her, "I'm sorry. I don't even wet my bed. I never have. I ain't a bedwetter. I just got a cold, and I got excited. I'm just having a bad day. I'm really good," he cried. "I'm the best one."
"It's all right. It's all right. Get back in," she said to him.
But Curly was already sprinting through the weeds and around the far corner of the building. "The poor kid just wet his pants," Candy said to Wally, who saw the way Candy held David Copperfield in her lap and felt himself breaking.
"Please," he whispered to her. "You don't have to do this. You can have the baby. I want the baby. I want your baby. It would be fine. We can just turn around," he pleaded with her.
But she said, "No, Wally, I'm all right. It's not the time for us to have a baby." She put her face down on David Copperfield's damp neck. The boy smelled both sweet and mildewed. The car stood still.
"Are you sure?" Wally whispered to her. "You don't have to."
She loved him for saying just the right thing at the right time, but Candy Kendall was more practical than Wally Worthington,
and she had her father's stubbornness when her mind was made up. She was no waffler.
"The boy said you go left," Candy said to Wally. "Go left."
Mrs. Grogan, across the road in the girls' division entrance, observed the Cadillac's hesitation. She had not seen Curly Day flee from the car, and she did not recognize the small child in the pretty girl's lap. Mrs. Grogan assumed that the child belonged to the pretty girl. She wondered if she'd ever seen a girl that pretty. And her young man was certainly handsome, almost too handsome for a husband, as they say in Maine. In Mrs. Grogan's opinion, they looked too young to be adopting anyone. Too bad, she mused, because they certainly seemed well off. A Cadillac meant nothing to Mrs. Grogan. It was the people themselves who appeared expensive to her. She was puzzled by how charmed she felt to be looking at these lovely people. Her few glimpses of the very rich had not charmed Mrs. Grogan in the past. Those glimpses had only made her feel bitter on behalf of the unadopted girls. She was all for her girls, Mrs. Grogan was. There was nothing personal in her bitterness, and very little that was personal in her whole life, really. The car stood still, giving Mrs. Grogan a long view. Oh, the poor dears, she thought. They are not married. They have had this child together. Either he or she is being disinherited. They have both clearly been disgraced, and now they have come to give up their child. But they are hesitating. She wanted to rush out and tell them, keep the child, drive away. She felt paralyzed by the drama she was imagining. Don't do it, she whispered, mustering the strength for an enormous telepathic signal. It was the signal Wally felt when he told Candy that she didn't have to. But then the car started up again. It was not turning around. It was heading straight for the hospital entrance of the boys' division. And Mrs. Grogan's heart sank. Boy or girl? She wondered numbly. What the fuck is going on? Wondered Melanie at her bitter window. Because of the harsh overhead light in the dormitory, Melanie could see her own face reflected in the window. She watched the white Cadillac halt on her upper lip. Curly Day escaped across her cheek, and the pretty blonde girl's arms enclosed David Copperfield at Melanie's throat. It was as close as Melanie came to looking in a mirror. It was not that she was troubled by the heaviness of her face, or how close together her eyes were, or how her hair rebelled. It was her own expression that upset her. The vacantness, the absence of energy. Formerly, she imagined, she had at least had energy. She couldn't remember when she'd last looked at herself in a mirror. What troubled her now was that she'd just seen this familiar vacantness on the face of Homer Wells when he'd lifted the station master's body. It wasn't the absence of strain, it was that look of zero surprise. Melanie was afraid of Homer. How things had changed, she thought. She'd wanted to remind him of his promise. You won't leave, will you? She'd almost asked. You'll take me if you run away, she'd wanted to say. But her familiarity with his new expression, because it was her nearly constant expression, she was sure, had paralyzed her. Now who are these pretty people? She wondered. Some car, she thought. She'd not seen their faces, but even the backs of their heads had discomforted her. The man's blonde hair had contrasted so perfectly with the smooth, tanned back of his neck that it had given her a shiver. And how could the back of the girl's head be so perfect, the bounce and swing of her hair so accurate? Was there some trick to aligning the length of the hair so exactly with the girl's straight but small shoulders? And it was positively graceful how she'd picked up young Copperfield and held him in her lap. That little runt, thought Melanie. She must have said the word runt half aloud, because her breath fogged the window at that instant. She lost sight of her own mouth and nose. When the window cleared, she saw the car move on toward the hospital entrance. People like that are too perfect to need an abortion, Melanie imagined. They're too perfect to fuck, she thought bitterly. They're too clean to do it. The pretty girl wonders why she can't get pregnant. She doesn't know you have to fuck first. They're considering adopting someone, but they won't find anyone here. There's no one who's good enough for them, thought Melanie, hating them. She spat straight into her own dull reflection and watched her spit run down the pane. She hadn't the energy to move. There was a time, she thought, when I would have at least gone outdoors and poked around the Cadillac. Maybe they would leave something in the car, something good enough to steal. But now,
Not even the thought of something to steal could move Melanie from her window. Dr. Larch had performed the first abortion with Nurse Edna's assistance. Larch had asked Homer to check on the contractions of the expectant mother from Damariscotta. Nurse Angela was assisting Larch with the second abortion, but Dr. Larch had insisted on Homer's presence, too. He had supervised Homer's ether application. Dr. Larch had such a light touch with ether that the first abortion patient had been speaking to Nurse Edna throughout the operation, and yet the woman hadn't felt a thing. She talked and talked, a kind of airy list of non sequiturs to which Nurse Edna responded with enthusiasm. Homer had put the second woman out, and he was clearly cross with himself for sedating the woman more heavily than he'd meant to. "Better safe than sorry," Nurse Angela said encouragingly, her hands on the woman's pale temples, which she instinctively smoothed with her soft hands. Larch had asked Homer to insert the vaginal speculum, and Homer now stared darkly at the woman's shiny cervix, at the puckered opening of the uterus. Bathed in a clear mucus, it had an aura of morning mist, of dew, of the pink clouds of a sunrise gathered around it. If Wally Worthington had peered through the speculum, he would have imagined that he was viewing an apple in some pale, ethereal phase of its development. "But what is that little opening?" he might have wondered. "How's it look?" Larch asked. "It looks fine," said Homer Wells. To his surprise, Larch handed him the cervical stabilizer, a simple instrument. It was for grabbing the upper lip of the cervix and stabilizing the cervix, which was then sounded for depth and dilated. "Didn't you get what I told you?" Homer asked Dr. Larch. "Do you disapprove of touching the cervix, Homer?" Larch asked. Homer reached for the lip of the woman's cervix and seized it correctly. "I won't touch a single dilator," he thought. "He won't make me." But Larch didn't even ask. He said, "Thank you, that's a help." He sounded and dilated the cervix himself. When he asked for the curette, Homer handed it to him. "You remember that I asked you if it was necessary for me to even be here?" Homer asked quietly. "I said that if it was all the same to you, I'd just as soon not watch. You remember?" "It's necessary for you to watch," said Wilbur Larch, who listened to the scrape of his curette. His breathing was shallow but regular. "I believe," said Dr. Larch, "that you should participate to the degree of watching, of lending some amateur assistance, of understanding the process, of learning how to perform it, whether you ever choose to perform it or not." "Do I interfere?" Larch asked. "When absolutely helpless women tell me that they simply can't have an abortion, that they simply must go through with having another, and yet another orphan, do I interfere, do I?" "I do not," he said, scraping. "I deliver it, goddammit. And do you think there are largely happy histories for the babies born here? Do you think the futures of these orphans are rosy, do you?" "You don't," Larch said. "But do I resist? I do not. I do not even recommend. I give them what they want, an orphan or an abortion," Larch said. "Well, I'm an orphan," said Homer Wells. "Do I insist that we have the same ideas? I do not," Dr. Larch said. "You wish it," said Homer Wells. "The women who come to me are not helped by wishes," said Wilbur Larch. He put down the medium-sized curette and held out his hand for a smaller one, which Homer Wells had ready for him and handed to him automatically. "I want to be of use," Homer began, but Dr. Larch wouldn't listen. "Then you are not permitted to hide," Larch said. "You are not permitted to look away. It was you who told me, correctly, that if you were going to be of use, if you were going to participate at all, you had to know everything. Nothing could be kept from you. I learned that from you." "Well, you're right," Larch said. "You were right," he added. "It's alive," said Homer Wells. "That's the only thing." "You are involved in a process," said Dr. Larch. "Birth on occasion and interrupting it on other occasions. Your disapproval is noted. It is legitimate. You are welcome to disapprove. But you are not welcome to be ignorant, to look the other way, to be unable to perform, should you change your mind." "I won't change my mind," said Homer Wells. "All right, then," said Dr. Larch. "Should you, against your will, but for the life of the mother, for example, should you have to perform?" I'm not a doctor, said Homer Wells.
You are not a complete physician, said Dr. Larch, and you could study with me for another 10 years, and you still wouldn't be complete. But regarding all the known complications arising in the area of the female organs of generation, regarding those organs, you can be a complete surgeon. Period. You are already more competent than the most competent midwife, damn it, said Wilbur Larch.
Homer had anticipated the extraction of the small curette. He handed Larch the first of several sterile vulval pads.
I will never make you do what you disapprove of, Homer, said Dr. Larch, but you will watch. You will know how to do what I do. Otherwise, what good am I? He asked. Aren't we put on this earth to work, at least to learn, at least to watch? What do you think it means to be of use? He asked. Do you think you should be left alone? Do you think I should let you be a Melanie?
Why don't you teach her how to do it? Homer Wells asked Dr. Larch.
Now there's a question, Nurse Angela thought, but the woman's head moved slightly in Nurse Angela's hands. The woman moaned, and Nurse Angela touched her lips to the woman's ear.
You're just fine, dear, she whispered. It's all over now. You just rest.
Do you see what I mean, Homer? Dr. Larch asked.
Right, Homer said.
But you don't agree, do you? Larch asked.
Right again, said Homer Wells.
You damn sullen, self-centered, self-pitying, arrogant, untested, know-nothing teenager, thought Wilbur Larch. But instead of any of that, he said to Homer Wells, perhaps you're having second thoughts about becoming a doctor.
I never really had a first thought about that, Homer said.
I never said I wanted to be a doctor.
Larch looked at the blood on the gauze, the right amount of blood, he thought. And when he held out his hand for a fresh pad, Homer had one ready.
You don't want to be a doctor, Homer? Dr. Larch asked.
Right, said Homer Wells. I don't think so.
You've not had much opportunity to look at other things, Larch said philosophically. His heart was aching.
It's my fault, I know, if I've made medicine so unattractive.
Nurse Angela, who was much tougher than Nurse Edna, felt that she might cry.
Nothing's your fault, Homer said quickly.
Wilbur Larch checked the bleeding again.
There's not much to do here, he said abruptly. If you wouldn't mind just staying with her until she's out of the ether. You did rather give her a wallop, he added, looking under the woman's eyelids.
I can deliver the Damariscotta woman when she's ready. I didn't realize you didn't like the whole business, Larch said.
That's not true, Homer said. I can deliver the Damariscotta woman. I'd be happy to deliver her.
But Wilbur Larch had turned away from the patient and left the operating room.
Nurse Angela glanced quickly at Homer. It was a fairly neutral look, certainly not withering or even faintly condemning, but it wasn't sympathetic either. Or even friendly, thought Homer Wells. She went after Dr. Larch, leaving Homer with the patient making her way out of the ether. Homer looked at the spotting on the pad. He felt the woman's hand graze his wrist as she said groggily,
I'll wait here while you get the car, honey.
In the boys' shower room, where there were several toilet stalls, Wilbur Larch put cold water on his face and looked for evidence of his tears in the mirror. He was no more a veteran of mirrors than Melanie was, and Dr. Larch was surprised by his appearance.
How long have I been so old? He wondered.
Behind him in the mirror, he recognized the pile of sodden clothes upon the floor as belonging to Curly Day.
Curly? He asked. He thought he was alone, but Curly Day was crying, too, in one of the toilet stalls.
I'm having a very bad day, Curly announced.
Let's talk about it, Dr. Larch suggested, which coaxed Curly out of the stall. He was dressed in more or less fresh clothes, but Larch recognized that the clothes weren't Curly's. They were some of Homer's old clothes, too small for Homer now, but still much too large for Curly Day.
I'm trying to look nice for the nice couple, Curly explained. I want them to take me.
Take you, Curly? Dr. Larch asked.
What nice couple?
You know, said Curly, who believed that Dr. Larch knew everything. The beautiful woman, the white car?
The poor child is having visions, thought Wilbur Larch, who picked Curly up in his arms and sat him down on the edge of the sink, where he could observe the boy more closely. "Or are they here to adopt someone else?" Curly asked miserably. "I think the woman likes Copperfield, but he can't even talk." "No one's adopting anyone today, Curly," Dr. Larch said. "I don't have any appointments today."
"Maybe they've just come to look," Curly suggested. "They're just going to take the best of us."
"It doesn't work like that, Curly," Dr. Larch said, alarmed. "Does a child think I run a pet shop?" Larch wondered. "Does he think I let people come here and browse?"
"I don't know how anything works," Curly said, and he started to cry again.
Wilbur Larch, with his fresh memory of how old he looked to himself in the mirror, thought for a moment that his job was too much for him. He felt himself slipping. He felt himself wishing that someone would adopt him, would just take him away. He held Curly Day's wet face against his chest. He shut his eyes and saw those spots he saw most regularly when he inhaled the ether, only those spots quite harshly reminded him of the spotting he was familiar with from his many viewings of the sterile vulval pads. He looked at Curly Day and wondered if Curly ever would be adopted, or if Curly was in danger of becoming another Homer Wells. Nurse Angela paused by the door to the boys' shower room. She listened to Dr. Larch comforting Curly Day. She was more worried about Dr. Larch than she was worried about Curly. A kind of stubborn goading had developed between Dr. Larch and Homer Wells that Nurse Angela had never expected to see existing between two people who so clearly loved and needed each other. It distressed her that she was powerless to intervene. She heard Nurse Edna calling her and was grateful for the interruption. She decided it would be easier to talk to Homer than to Dr. Larch. She'd not decided what should be said to either of them. Homer watched the second abortion patient emerge from the ether. He moved her from the operating table to a portable bed. He put up the safety rails on the bed in case the woman was groggy. He looked in another room and saw that the first abortion patient was already sitting up, but he decided both women would rather be alone for a moment, and so he left the second patient in the operating room. It wasn't time to deliver the Damariscotta woman, he was sure. The tiny hospital felt especially cramped and overcrowded to him, and he longed for a room of his own. But first he knew he had to apologize for hurting Dr. Larch's feelings. It had all just slipped out of him, and it made him almost cry to think that he had caused Dr. Larch any suffering. He went straight across the hall to the dispensary, where he could see what he thought were Dr. Larch's feet extending off the foot of the dispensary bed. The dispensary medicine cabinets blocked the rest of the bed from view. He spoke to Dr. Larch's feet, which to Homer's surprise were larger than he remembered them. He was also surprised that Dr. Larch, a neat man, had left his shoes on and that his shoes were muddy. "Dr. Larch," Homer said, "I'm sorry." When there was no response, Homer thought crossly to himself that Dr. Larch was under an unusually ill-timed ether sedation. "I'm sorry, and I love you," Homer added, a little louder. He held his breath, listening for Larch's breathing, which he couldn't hear. Alarmed, he stepped around the cabinets and saw the lifeless station master stretched out on Larch's bed. It did not occur to Homer that this had been the first time someone had said, "I love you," to the station master. There had been no better place to put him. Nurse Edna and Nurse Angela had moved him out of the operating room. It would have been cruel to expect one of the abortion patients to tolerate his presence, or to put him alongside the expectant mother, and certainly it would have been upsetting to the orphans if the station master had been stretched out on one of the dormitory beds. "God damn it," Homer said. "What's that?" Larch asked. He was carrying Curly Day and calling to Homer from the dispensary door. "Nothing," Homer Wells said. "Never mind." "Curly's been having a very bad day," Dr. Larch explained. "That's too bad, Curly," Homer said. "Someone's come here to adopt someone," Curly said. "They're sort of shopping."
"I don't think so, Curly," Dr. Larch said.
"Tell them I'm the best one, okay, Homer?"
Curly asked.
Right, said Homer Wells. You're the best.
Wilbur, Nurse Edna was calling. She and Nurse Angela were chattering at the hospital entrance door. They traipsed out to see what was going on, the doctor, his unwilling apprentice, and the next-to-oldest orphan in the boys' division. There was a small but busy crowd around the Cadillac. The trunk was open, and the handsome young man was dispensing presents to the orphans.
"Sorry it's not the season for apples, kids," Wally was saying. "Or cider. You could all use a little cider," he said cheerfully, handing out the jars of honey, the crab apple, and apple cider jelly.
The eager, dirty hands were grabbing. Mary Agnes Cork, the next-to-oldest orphan in the girls' division, was getting more than her share. Melanie had taught her how to dominate the front of a line. Mary Agnes was a popular name with Mrs. Grogan, and Cork was the county in Ireland where Mrs. Grogan had been born. There had been a number of little Corks in the girls' division.
"There's plenty to go around," Wally said optimistically, as Mary Agnes put two honeys and one crabapple down her blouse, then reached for more. A boy named Smokey Fields had opened his jar of apple cider jelly and was eating it out of the jar with his hand.
"It's really good on toast in the morning," Wally said cautiously, but Smokey Fields stared at Wally as if toast was not a regular item on his diet or reliably available in the morning. Smokey Fields intended to finish the jar of jelly on the spot. Mary Agnes spied a horn-rimmed beret on the convertible's back seat. It was one that Candy had put aside. Mary Agnes turned to face Candy, then dropped a second jar of crabapple jelly at Candy's feet.
"Oops," Candy said, bending to pick up the jelly for her while Mary Agnes stole the beret, little John Walsh observing her deft moves admiringly. A trace of blood, or maybe rust, on Mary Agnes's bare shin caught Candy's eye and made her feel queasy. She needed to restrain herself from wetting her finger and trying to rub the streak away. When she stood up and handed the girl her jar of jelly, Candy felt a little dizzy. Some grown-ups were coming out of the hospital entrance, and their presence helped Candy compose herself. "I've not come here to play with the children," she thought. "I'm Dr. Larch," the old man was saying to Wally, who seemed transfixed by the determination with which Smokey Fields was devouring the jar full of apple cider jelly. "Wally Worthington," Wally said, pumping Dr. Larch's hand, handing him a jar of Ira Titcomb's honey. "Fresh from Ocean View Orchards. That's in Hart's Rock, but we're very near the coast. We're in Hart's Haven, almost."
"Hart's Haven," said Wilbur Larch, examining the honey. A sea breeze seemed to spring off the boy, as distinctive, Larch thought, as fresh, crisp $100 bills. Whose face was on $100 bill? Larch tried to imagine.
"Tell her," Curly Day said to Homer Wells, pointing to Candy, but there was no need to point. Homer Wells had seen her, and only her, from the moment he emerged from the hospital entrance. Young Copperfield clung to her leg, but this didn't seem to impede her gracefulness, and nothing could interfere with her radiance.
"Tell her I'm the best one," Curly said to Homer.
"Hello," Candy said to Homer, because he was the tallest person present. He was as tall as Wally.
"I'm Candy Kendall," she said to him. "I hope we're not interrupting anything."
You are interrupting two abortions, one birth, one death, two autopsies, and an argument, thought Homer Wells, but all he said was,
"He's the best one."
Too mechanically, thought Curly Day. He lacks conviction.
"Me," Curly said, stepping between them. "He means me. I'm the best."
Candy bent over Curly and ruffled his sticky hair.
"Of course you are," she said brightly.
And straightening up, she said to Homer, "And do you work here? Or are you one of..." Was it polite to say them, she wondered.
"Not exactly," Homer mumbled, thinking, "I work here, inexactly, and I am, inexactly, one of them."
"His name's Homer Wells," Curly told Candy, since Homer had failed to introduce himself.
"He's too old to adopt."
"I can see that," Candy said, feeling shy. "I should be talking to the doctor," she thought awkwardly. She was irritated with Wally for creating such a crowd.
"I'm in the apple business," Wally was saying to Dr. Larch. "It's my father's business. Actually," he added, "my mother's business."
"What does this fool want?" thought Wilbur Larch.
"Oh, I love apples," said Nurse Edna. "I would have brought lots of apples," Wally said, "but it's the wrong time of year. You should have your own apples."
He indicated the barren hillside stretching behind them.
"Look at that hill," he said. "It's washing away. You ought to plant it.
I could even get you the trees. In 6 or 7 years, you'd have your own apples. You'd have apples for more than 100 years.
What do I want with 100 years of apples? Thought Will.